knowledge of the market, convenience, and the need to control. So if I'm going to get investors to wire money to me, I have to have that fiduciary responsibility and be able to account it. And if the property's far away and I have to hop on a plane or drive 5 hours to get to it, the number of times I'm going to check on the property is much less.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today on the podcast, we've got Sandhya Chaudhry. She is a real estate investor in Dallas, Texas. She's lived there for the last 30 plus years. Started out her career in electrical engineering, got her MBA, spent a bunch of time investing in the stock market before realizing she needed to offset some of the taxes that she was going to have to pay from her stock winnings and fell into the real estate game full time. She focuses on deals only in Dallas, Fort Worth. So we talk a lot about Dallas. And one of the things that we really dig into, which I think is really important now in recording this in July of 2023, is how to actually operate deals versus letting the market just make the deal look really good. So we dig into multifamily operations, how you can manage expenses, manage your income growth, and still return positive results to your investors. So let's get Sandhya on the pod. All right, Sandhya, thank you for being on the pod. Really happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Justin. Very excited to be here and look forward to adding value to your listeners.
Awesome. Well, let's start that process. Maybe give everybody a bit of an introduction into who you are, and then we'll dig into your journey and all that.
So I currently live in the Dallas area where I've lived for the last 33 years. I do full-time apartment syndications. We buy large apartments and we try to do value add and sell them in anywhere from 3 to 5 years and increasing investors' wealth. It's a way to diversify from the stock market. But I also invest passively. So I'm also an investor in other people's deals because I believe in this business. Prior to that, I started out like most Asian geeks with a math background and became an engineer. So electrical engineering, that was my first career, got an MBA in the process part-time and then got into the stock market and finally stumbled upon real estate as a way for me to reduce my taxes and have a business, but to where I also dictate my own schedule.
Got it. Well, that sounds like you've had a couple of careers over the last number of years. So maybe let's start out, talk about your W-2 world and how you even got exposed to the real estate game.
So engineering, W-2, I think all of us buy a primary home. We hear about friends doing fix and flip, single family rentals, et cetera. And I peeked over the shoulder of several of my friends doing that. And I felt like I just did not have that handy person background. And I didn't want to get that call on Thanksgiving Day with a leaky toilet. Or yep. For me to be able to assess how much truly a repair would cost. Just didn't grow up with a handy dad background. So I was not confident of doing those kind of rental properties. So when a friend told me about large scale syndications where you can pay a third party property management, have your own on-site staff to do the maintenance, the leasing, et cetera. And I'm more of an asset manager, which is pretty much project management that I was doing in my engineering world anyway. I attended a weekend seminar where they talked about syndications. You could buy these large apartments and afford third-party property management companies with on-site staff to run it for you. And so the asset management is what I do now full-time. And this is what I'm dedicated to. So all my deals are in the Dallas area within a 30-minute drive of my house. So I'm a control freak. I like to check on my properties whenever I can. So by the time I drive to the restaurant or I drive to the Dallas airport, I've already passed 2 or 3 properties along the way. And that's what I like to do is I focus a lot on the operations. So what happens after closing a deal and you have to execute the business plan and return money to investors.
Got it. Well, let's dig into a couple of those things here. So you mentioned that some of your friends or some of your other real estate exposure was fix and flip. And you were like, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole and saw these bigger deals as a more passive way for you to invest, but also be involved in the deal and more on the asset management side. So I guess let's talk a little about your first deal and how did you get exposure to it? It sounds like you maybe have joined a group or went to a conference. Like, how did that first deal come about? And what was your involvement in it? I guess let's start there.
So my first deal was actually a passive deal, which I use the analogy of being a passenger in a plane and somebody else is your pilot and co-pilot. I met these folks through a mentoring program that I joined based in Dallas. And the nice thing was we had a Christmas party and they were coming to look at their property anyway. So I went along with them. I drove to that property with them. I got to see it. I knew that location already, being a location expert, being in the Dallas area. I saw the potential. I was like, okay, 5 to 10 years from today, I know this building is going to increase in value. I see the huge market potential of Dallas, et cetera, the job growth, population growth, et cetera. The other thing was I was no longer in my W-2 at that time. I was full-time into the stock market. So I had all this retirement money that was still in retirement in a self-directed IRA. So that I was able to use to invest in this deal, which is a little less of a risk from my standpoint, because it's not money I'm counting on tomorrow for my cash flow and to pay for my immediate expenses. So I could take on the illiquid nature of real estate and wait a good 5 years if that's what was necessary for it to appreciate, rather than expecting me to get money back overnight. So that's how I got over the hump of my first passive deal. And it did extremely well, because this was back in December 2018 that I made this investment, and cap rates were great at that time. And they sold it in 2021, which was the best time to sell. So I more than doubled my money. So it was like a picture perfect textbook case of a great investment on the passive side. But that's how I got to do a few deals with my retirement money, get to know sponsors, get to know what I liked about multifamily, what were the risks. And then I got in as a general partner with two other experienced partners who I met through the same program. And that first GP deal was 86 doors, and it's in a place called Cleburne in Texas. Okay. And we bought it in 2019 and we sold it in 2021 and did a fantastic return for investors. Again, half of it due to the cap rate compression, but the other half due to actually everything going well. We wrote it out in the business plan. It was like a fairy tale. So we were able to like more than triple investors' money. But it was my two other partners who were located out of state who were the real brains behind the operations. And I was sort of the newbie learning, doing the execution, because they were out of state. COVID hit us in 2020. Yeah. They couldn't travel as much. So I learned a ton because I was the one who was showing up each time to the property to learn from the vendors, the contractors, and seeing all the rehabs happen, et cetera. So that was a fantastic learning experience for me. And I love the asset management aspect of it.
That's interesting. So you had very good timing in your first two deals, your first passive and your first GP deal. A lot of people are trying to time the market and you stumbled in and hit it at kind of the exact right time to participate in all of the craziness that went on in 2021, for sure, when a lot of people who bought deals earlier sold and made a lot of money. So that's congratulations to you and your investors. That's awesome. Real quickly too, you said that you quit or moved away from the engineering world and had been full-time in the stock market. What does that mean? And what were you working on in the stock market?
So I was also getting my MBA part-time while I was full-time as an engineer. And I moved on to more of a business role within my company, starting with an engineering role. So I know how to run a business, look at the profit and loss statements, those kind of things, which lends itself well to studying the stock market, studying stocks. Obviously, I knew my tech sector very well, but my MBA friends, we formed groups and we formed investor clubs. And those investments started doing really well. And so later on, when I had children, it made sense to have a more flexible schedule. There was a time when I was on a flight, I think, coming back from Taiwan, and my husband was supposed to leave the same day to go to Japan, and my flight was delayed. I was going to come only a day later, and we had an infant in the house. And so that was like one of the big aha moments that led to saying, okay, does this still make sense for us? What are we working this hard for? And why are we missing out on these things? And so I decided then that a couple of hours a day playing the stock market was plenty, and the rest of the time I could raise my children full time. And then we were doing well because, again, the stock market was doing well. It cooperated at that time. And that's why I had to look for a tax advantage in some way with the real estate.
Okay. So you're doing well in life and business. And then you're like, okay, well, now I got to pay all these taxes. So how do I legally figure out ways to invest and not have to pay as many taxes. So I guess let's talk a little bit about that first deal. How did you add value? I know obviously COVID hit and that was forced value add for you to be involved in that deal, but somebody like newer to the game, there are two other general partners, it sounds like, were you part of the general partnership landscape? Because there's a lot of ways to get involved in deals, whether it's finding the deal, asset managing, raising capital, et cetera, et cetera. But like, where did you fall in that spectrum to get involved in the GP?
So I had independently underwritten the deal. It was listed by Marcus and Millichap, and so had they. And I realized we're both in the same program. Yeah. And why are we competing against each other? Let me help you. And this is how I'm going to help you, is I'm not going to ask you how much I'm going to get compensated. I'm going to instead see, what can I learn from you? Can I be in every weekly asset management call? Can I get involved in every little aspect of this deal from A to Z and learn? Because I really don't want to go on my own without any prior experience on my first deal when it involves other people's money. So boots on the ground, asset management, local person to be the brawn to execute a lot of these things while they're the brains deciding on the strategy and being part of the weekly calls and then participating. And then the other aspect that came into play is, as a PTA mom, I'm full of all these ideas to grow a community and build it. Because when I came to live here, I was in an apartment as a not so rich student, right? Starving student mentality. And I used to go to this college called SMU in Highland Park, a very fancy part of Dallas, and see all this cul-de-sac environment. And I wanted to create that in my properties. So we had periodic resident activities. And the way it ties back to financials is that we have much better retention at our properties. We compensate our on-site staff based on their renewal numbers rather than new leases. And so every month we would have some activity. So even when COVID happened, we filled goodie bags with things like toilet paper and sanitizer, things that were hard to find. We put it at everybody's door. And then those who couldn't pay because they truly lost their jobs, we helped them fill out the applications so that they had rent relief. And that's why that deal, despite being most of the whole period through COVID, did so phenomenally well that we were able to more than triple investors' money.
Interesting. No, that's super helpful. I want to dig into some other operational things, because I think that's, especially now, we're recording this July 5th, 2023, and the market is not as hot as it was back in 2021, 22. So I want to dig into some of the operational things, because I think that's really important now to operate these deals. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick sponsor break. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
We are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about your first deal and how phenomenally well it did, given that you'd bought it in 2019, sold it in 2021. The market was obviously on fire during that period. But now we're recording this in mid-2023, high interest rates. And really where you're going to get value out of properties is not by the market saving a deal by cap rate compression and pricing going through the roof. It's really on operations, right? So having a good property manager, having a good asset manager that knows how to manage a property manager is vitally important to generate the returns at minimum what you outlined in your pro forma to your investors. So maybe talk through some of the things that you're doing in deals that you're in now that are helping to achieve your results, to achieve your returns for investors. Because operations, it's, I call it the year of the asset manager. It's really focused on how you're actually managing and operating your properties. So what are your thoughts and tips and tricks that you're doing with some of the deals you're in now?
Asset management is really about risk management. So you want to see what are the risks that are going to come forward. So the Fed is not going to stop the increase in interest rates. So what if interest rates aren't coming down in the next 2 or 3 years? Can you survive till 2025 or beyond? So are you on a floating rate loan deal or are you on a fixed rate loan deal? What is the source of your cash? So what do you need? How is your DSCR? That's the first assessment I would do, is your debt service coverage ratio. Is your net operating income enough to support your mortgage payment? And then do you have money to spend on deferred maintenance issues as well as your capital expenses? So anytime you take over a property, let's say you're taking over a property right now in this environment, the first thing you should do is you should look at the bosses. Your bosses are basically your lender, your city inspector, and your insurance company. They will give you a list of repairs to do. So make sure you have enough money for them before you go spending $300K on exterior paint and nice brand new signage and $20K interior. So that's the number one. So make sure you have money left for all of those, depending on the age of your property and the physical due diligence you've done. Keep money extra for that. Each location has different risks depending on the weather. We get a lot of storms in Dallas, so definitely be prepared to put some money up, fund those repairs before you get paid back by insurance. In terms of your general KPIs, right? Collections is always your number one number, right? You make sure your on-site manager knows what that number is. So today we're speaking on the 5th of July. Well, we had a holiday, but otherwise normally by the 5th, you should have paid your rent. So you should have a tracking of by the 5th, the 10th of every month, the 15th of every month, how much have I collected versus what is my number needs to be. The second is your operating expenses. And in places like Texas, especially, both insurance and property taxes are going up significantly that affect your operating expenses. So you've got to do a better job in other things to balance that out so that your NOI still stays where it needs to be and keeps growing. So are you spending money on the right marketing channels, as an example? Do you have an occupancy problem? Because if you don't, because some of my properties are in locations like Irving, we're always well into the 90s. So why am I spending $2,000 a month on various websites or programs to pay for it, when instead I'm going to put a couple of hundred bucks a month instead into resident activities, improve that retention number, see if I can convince a resident to stay if they've been a good paying resident. We look at that list and just give them maybe, hey, let me give you a new refrigerator. Let me give you a new fan. And maybe you just take a weekend off and we'll come in and resurface the tub and fix a couple of things and you just stay. Then you focus on renewal and retention a little bit more so that you're not spending that $20K or $10K on an interior upgrade, plus losing those days when the unit is vacant and not collecting rent. You're still responsible for paying the utilities. It's what we call the box score. We track how many days a unit has been vacant. That's a very important measure when it comes to unit terms. So your collections are important, your operating expenses are important, and then your net operating income. Then you get into, of course, your occupancy and then your delinquency, right? You may be 100% physically occupied or 90 residents are paying, then that remaining 10% needs to get collected, right? Or maybe they're not paying the full rent, the market rent, because their lease is from 2 or 3 years ago and they've not caught up. So there's a loss to lease. So all the different factors that contribute to what we call economic vacancy, right? You want to go into that and see how you can minimize that number. There's another thing we like to track is your expense ratio. At the beginning, when you take over a property, it might be high, but you want to get it down to between 40 to 50%, your operating expenses as a total percentage.
Yep.
So those are all the different things that we track. Then, of course, your capital expenses and your deferred maintenance. Like I said, listen to your bosses, the city, the lender, and your insurance will give you a list of things you may have to do, whether you like it or not. You may still have to replace some old piece of equipment, plan for so many ACs to get replaced every year, et cetera. So hopefully you did a thorough job of your physical due diligence and you have a budget that's separated into CapEx that's going to get me additional rent versus this deferred maintenance list. The other thing is when you want to spend money on CapEx, right? Whether that's an interior upgrade or an exterior, did your property management company who's running the property for you agree that you're going to get a $200 rent bump just because you put in a steel appliance, right? Is that realistic based on the median household income and the affordability there in that area?
Yeah, you don't want to over-renovate and put granite where nobody else has granite, and then you just spend a bunch of money where you're not going to get the benefit or the return on that investment. So
you got to look at your ROI and your payback period.
Yeah.
So I would rather put in washer dryers if I can for $1,200 to $1,500 and charge an extra $30, $40 a month, because it's actually an amenity a resident would want to pay for rather than, oh, I put granite just because I feel like it. Well, it's a C-class property in this area. It doesn't really need it. They don't care.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. And we glossed over what's happened since the 86 units. So maybe catch us up on, obviously, it sounds like just based on that last overview, you've got a lot of experience in this world. So where are you kind of present day as far as like deals that you've done, GPLP, catch us up on that track record that you've had?
I actually have 26 deals as a limited partner from my retirement account money that I never actually brought into as my real cash. So it's still sitting as retirement funds. I've got 8 deals as a general partner and 3 have sold. So I currently actively manage about 5 properties in the Dallas area.
Got it. And you mentioned that you focus solely on Dallas. I'm curious, obviously, Dallas is a very hot, attractive market, very competitive market. I live in Austin, which is very similar in the competitiveness of it. But I guess, why only Dallas? Why not expand out and look at other markets? Just curious.
So Dallas has served me well so far. I haven't had a bad deal, right? So in that sense, why not have more control that I could visit the property anytime I want? I know this market inside out. I don't have to under 100 deals. Somebody sends me an address, I can pretty much say yes or no. So I'm not interested in Polk Street or Polk Villas as an example, which is in South Dallas, versus Beltline Road in Irving or Carrollton, because I know those areas so well. I don't need to think about it. I underwrite much fewer deals for that reasons, just knowledge of the market, convenience, and the need to control. So if I'm going to get investors to wire money to me, I feel like I have to have that fiduciary responsibility and be able to account it. And if the property's far away and I have to hop on a plane or drive 5 hours to get to it, the number of times I'm going to check on the property is much less. And so since we focus a lot on value add deals, I think at the beginning, especially, it's important to go frequently. Or let's say you change property management companies. One of the things I like to do is sit in the back office with my laptop and literally office from there those first few weeks, just to help them out in terms of making quick decisions so that they're not waiting on approvals. They don't have all systems set up in place, et cetera. And things go much faster. You have a relationship established with your onsite, but you also have a pulse of the property. So you really know what's going on. What kind of resident activities am I seeing here? Just what is this property all about? Can it sustain itself, or do I have to spend a lot of money to really improve the true problems? What are people complaining about, et cetera?
No, that's super interesting. Obviously, any kind of real estate book that you read typically tells people to invest where they live. That's typically on the single family side, because obviously there's a lot more single family in your general vicinity, but doing it from a multifamily perspective makes a ton of sense. And to your point, you know the area because you've probably driven past all of the deals that you've looked at least once or twice. I'm kind of curious, you mentioned having people wire you money. So what aspects of the multifamily syndication world are you doing now? Are you hunting deals, analyzing deals, raising money? Are you doing all the deals by yourself? Or are you still partnering up with a lot of other people from a true syndication style?
I have at least two other partners on every deal. And some deals I have three or four partners, but we try to limit it to five total just because of the different responsibilities involved. And I've played different roles depending on the strengths of my partners. But right now, I always have to underwrite the deals myself, even if a partner first underwrites it. Mm. I think we all have to raise capital now. Cost of capital has gone up. So it's not a role I could say, not going to raise any capital at all. We just all have to do that.
Yeah.
And then the operations, I have to be on the asset management calls. That's important to me as a personal preference. So I can't stay away from that. But let's just say I have a partner, for example, who loves to do all this taxes stuff, right? He's got an accounting background, et cetera. So he's going to be the one who's going to interface with the accountant to take care of all the K-1s. We have another partner who's a PhD in electrical engineering and loves systems and things. So he's the one who's going to have all those conversations about the big systems, whether it's air conditioners, chillers, any other equipment that we have to deal with. He's the one having those contractor conversations. I typically tend to go in and do all the interiors. But budget-wise, I keep a pretty tight control over the budget and make sure our spending is within reason. And why are we exceeding the budget, whether that's normal operating expenses or the CapEx or the deferred maintenance aspects of it? I mean, your lender could come and tell you to repair the parking lot and it could cost you $200K. And you might not have paid for that.
Yeah, you didn't budget for that.
So I do all aspects of it, but more so depending on what are some other people's favorites.
Yeah.
And I can go either way. Like the main person who's interfaced with the lender, that's a whole job by itself in keeping up with the lender, especially if it involves lender draws, right? Versus a pretty loan, if you raise your own money, it's a lot easier. You just say, okay, today this is my plan. Next week I'm going to change it and that's okay. Versus some other lenders, that's a whole dedicated person to interface with the lender. I'm usually the one to show up on site whenever any inspection is involved because I want to make sure the city inspector is aware that I'm very much hands-on and involved. So lender inspection, city inspection, I try to be in person when the COSSEG people come through.
Yeah.
So I tell them, hey, this is my target. My investors are expecting this much. So let's go see creative here and see what we can depreciate. What other information can I get you?
Got it. No, it's interesting. And I'm curious, we're in a unique, not as hot of a market, as we mentioned, as 2021 was. Are you still looking for deals? Are you just more, let's batten down the hatches and operate the deals that maybe you bought recently that, I don't know if you buy on variable rate debt, but there are a lot of value add deals that's the model that you go with, right? You get a bridge loan for the first 2 to 3 years. It's got floating rate debt. So obviously, if you bought it in 22, your interest rates went through the roof. And so now you've got to manage a higher debt service, right? So maybe talk through that evolution in some of the deals that you've done recently or purchased recently and how they're trending and what you're doing to make sure that you're able to execute the plan that you outlined to your investors.
So we do have a couple of deals on variable rate loan. I'm just blessed that our financial advisors at that time told us to get 3-year rate caps. So they're not expiring anytime soon. The first one is like middle of 2024. So I still got a bit of a runway. So what we do periodically is every quarter, I send my financials to two different people. One of them is my lender broker, who's constantly having a pulse on the market and the interest rates and can tell me how much proceeds I can get. Because there's a certain magic number I need in proceeds to be able to refi. And then the other person is my listing broker. And I tell him, I need this kind of a price. And he's like, well, you're still off by a million. Go do this. Why is your water bill so high this month? Is there a leak? Go fix these things I need you to do. So both of them give me direction and strategies on a quarterly basis as to how I need to steer the ship. And then we communicate that again with our property management company so that we're in process to list it for sale or refi by a certain date. My earliest date is March of next year. I have one deal for which I got to be ready by then. So I've got another 8 months of runway. Yeah. But we've got a monthly plan as to where all the things need to go to accomplish that. And you have to be cash tight with these things. So that's why the ROI on every dollar that's spent has to be analyzed very closely. So whenever pest control comes in, we're like, okay, can you please let me know if there were any pets in that room, in that unit that they forgot to declare? So that's an easy time to check that. So we just tell the pest control guys to give us that information, or we go in and say, maintenance is going to change filters, and we go check for little things like that. Your reserved parking is always less expensive way for you to spend CapEx as a general partner, because it's just a stripe versus covered parking involves permits and structures, et cetera. So for example, we give reserved parking for free on your first month's lease. So maybe you like it and you want to keep it, and then you pay for the rest. So find ways to add value and things that residents don't mind paying for.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess, are you still actively hunting deals right now? I know the first quarter of the year, it felt like there was only a trickle of properties being listed, obviously with rates going through the roof and uncertainty what was going on with the general macro economy. But now we're in somewhat of, I guess, more steady state, if you will. Interest rates aren't going up as much. But I guess, yeah, are you actively still looking at deals? What do you think the back half of 23 with your crystal ball, what do you think the back half of 23 is going to look like?
I think there's going to be more and more deals and a little bit of distress. So the gap between what the seller expectations are versus what the buyer can afford in terms of loan proceeds, I think we're getting closer to bridge that gap. And so definitely still looking at deals. Brokers are still sending a lot more deals now in Q2 and Q3. We've seen a lot more deal flow than in the past. But again, I have a very tight little box of criteria. And so if a deal comes through that fits my criteria, I'm going to spend all night analyzing it so I can make an offer as soon as possible, right? Because I'm going to go after it. And I've got the track record that brokers know I can close a deal in this local market. I have 4 brokers literally living in my neighborhood. So I can walk to their houses. I have the relationship and I have the bigger clout of the mentoring program. So it's not going to be a huge problem to get deals awarded. It's more of, can I deliver to my investors with enough cash flow that they have sort of been spoiled as getting in the past?
Yeah.
And so when your leverage goes down and the cost of capital goes up, and your cash flow is usually a problem in that first year of operations.
Yeah. The deals that you're underwriting, you mentioned you've got this box score to make sure that if they check those boxes, then you go after it pretty hard. Are you seeing deals with lower returns that you're still interested in than maybe you would have passed on probably 2 years ago, right? Like, is that what you're starting to look at right now?
Yeah, it's a little bit less in returns. And then you definitely have to poll your investors to see what their, how much of an appetite they have for deals of that kind. And then the older saying still goes, don't wait to buy real estate, buy real estate and wait. You got to keep reminding them that this is illiquid and long-term. So one of my investors said he's got a kid going to college in a couple of years. Will this deal sell? I'm like, I can't tell you that. Yeah. I don't know what the market conditions will be. So if you can't let go of this money for 5 years as somewhat illiquid, don't invest. I'm still seeing deals. They are penciling for a few lower returns than, of course, the good old days of 2019, 2020, 2021, et cetera. It all depends on the terms. So we were very fortunate in the last two deals to get like 70% leverage from Freddie Mac on fixed rate loans, but with a step down prepay. So you really want to watch for that. If your plan is to sell a deal in 4 years, but you've got this yield maintenance penalty on the back end, a lot of syndicators don't calculate that in their underwriting. But in year four or year five, there's not going to be much IO left, interest only left. So somebody's unlikely to assume your loan.
Right.
So then yield maintenance can hit you pretty hard. So that's something you want to take into consideration. So for me, it's basically location is everything. That's the one thing you can never change in real estate. So the crime data and all of those stuff, location and then the terms, right? What kind of a term sheet can I get? I'm still going for fixed rate loans, but I'm looking at my prepayment penalty. And so weighing that against, because my investors are not so happy about bridge loans or floating rate loans now. So I've got to have that formula that says it's a fixed rate loan, but I can still exit it in a reasonable way for them to invest.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious. I pull my investors and talk to them, you know, ever so often, and the appetite for investing is getting better, I would say. But what are you hearing from your investors, knowing that you probably have had a lot of success, especially in your early deals? But yeah, I'm curious if you're hearing the same sentiment of some people are holding on to cash now because they're just a little bit uncertain and scared, but others are the deal has to make sense and they're still willing to invest. Like, what are you hearing?
They want an investment now because there haven't been as many. So they still need something for their taxes, et cetera. A lot of my investors, a good percentage of them, need that depreciation. So it's at 80% this year, but it's also the cost for increasing it back to 100% is what I'm hearing in the news. So hopefully those good old days will come back. But right now, investors need something. We're already in July. So if you're not under contract in the next couple of months, right, your closing by December may not happen. So there is really a little bit of that sense of urgency among investors, and the appetite has improved today compared to like 4 months ago.
Yeah, you definitely probably have what, 3-4 months to get something under contract or to get it actually under contract and close it. So time is definitely ticking. And that's a good point. I've talked to a few people that mentioned they need it for the depreciation so that they don't get whacked with taxes and everything. So it sounds like you're still a buyer in this market. Obviously, the number doesn't make sense. Less deals out there, at least initially. It feels like there's definitely more coming or have been coming to market recently, which is good. You mentioned this mentorship group, and I'm curious if you think about back when you were in the W-2 world and a lot of my audience is actively working and they're looking for passive options. What are some ways that they can, I guess, dip their toe in their water even deeper than just listening to the podcast, but they can actually start to learn the knowledge and learn the vernacular and jargon? I joined a mentorship program. I think it's a massive value, but I wanted to jump in with both feet and be active and passive and everything. But I guess, what are your initial thoughts or guidance to somebody that's really looking for, they have a job they love, but they want to get more involved passively in the multifamily real estate world?
I think education is always number one. So if you can look at any example webinar slides, do you really understand all of it? What parts are still unknown to you? Do you understand those terms? That's where I tell people to start. So if somebody's talking to me today and wants to get into the business, I send them an example of an old deal, because then there's no pressure to invest, but then they come back with all their questions. I know what their risk tolerance is, but also do they really understand it? And then I tell them there's a lot of different networking groups, meetups, et cetera, that are completely free, but have a timeline by when your education and your knowledge is going to get to a certain level to where in 3 months from today, can you explain this entire webinar back to me? Do you understand all the terms and the risks associated with it, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't keep a deadline, you will drift. And so a year from today, you'll still be in the same place that you are today. So I tell people, find that extra 2 or 3 hours a week to go and learn something and document what that knowledge is. Otherwise, you'll just be learning, you'll be chasing the next shiny object without actually learning something. So once you do that and you attend a lot of meetups and podcasts, et cetera, on a regular basis, you're ready to make that investment. Really be sure about the risks and then have a checklist to vet a sponsorship team. It's just like when you play blackjack or you play any other game, there's a set of rules. Don't compromise. Don't get investor greed or don't get led by a shiny object. Look at the track record behind all that social media hype. Get a passive investor for a reference, just like when you hire a contractor for $50K to remodel your kitchen. Okay, you better ask for a reference, right? This is a $50K investment. Who's your reference? Who told you that person is great besides their own social media hype, right? So I have a checklist I developed with all my 20-something passive investments, all the mistakes as well as the things to watch for. And make sure it's money that you don't need for at least 5 years. You understand that it's illiquid, but at some point you have to play it, right? If you want to fly a plane, I think it's better to be a passenger first, at least once, right? So that's the way I look at it. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And I think the power of the self-directed IRA is so important that people, I didn't realize it when I was a W-2 worker and I had had previous jobs. That was how my wife and I got into our first two deals passively was, to your point, we wanted to learn the process from a passive investor side and the least risky way to do it because we didn't have mounds of capital or just to throw into a deal was we took an old 401k, put it into self-directed and invested passively that way. And there's a lot of money out there. People have just invested in the stock market, which you know very well, being that you worked in it for a long time. But the ability to have that capital and invest it and use it into a real estate game is definitely something that some people just don't realize they can do fairly easily, frankly. So I want to transition to the ending here, but I guess it sounds like at the end of the day, you're still looking at deals all in DFW. I guess, what's your typical target profile deal? Like what's the year, vintage, like all that? Are you in the 70s or 80s, 90s? What does that look like for you?
I've done older deals in the past in the 70s, even 60s, but now I'm hoping to do just Class B, which is 80s. So to not have any of the issues that happened on the properties before the standards were changed in 1978. So I still need a value add component to it. Otherwise, a pure yield play. Class A in particular, which is your newer properties, are quite expensive in Dallas to where it's almost is like cheaper to do new construction. So I'm still, my sweet spot is still Class B, excellent location, but in more of a Class A type of area where the median household income is well into the 60K and higher, so that you have at least a minimum of a 3X factor, as I call it. So if your monthly rent is 1500 times 12, you're at 18,000 times 3, you're at 54K. So you want to be more than that 60K for the median income because you're planning to push those rents and add more value. So you want to make sure it's you're not hitting some caps for the max that a renter can afford to pay there.
Yeah, no, that's super important. And I'm assuming 100 plus units that you target?
Yeah, minimum 100 plus doors, unless it's a small property very close to one of my existing properties, then we would take smaller numbers. But that's the sort of the sweet spot to where your property management company can run it with full-time staff employed on site and the economies of scale come into play. But then if I get into too many large numbers, then I'm competing with a big player. So it's sort of like that 100, 150 to 200 is sort of like my spot.
Yeah, especially in Dallas and here in Austin, once you hit like 250, then you start to get some PE money and some private equity and institutional capital coming in that has a lot more dollars to throw around. And they also can command less returns because they put it into a fund and all that fun stuff.
Exactly.
So no, it makes a ton of sense. Well, Sandy, let me transition to the final three pack of questions that I ask every guest, and then we'll wrap the show here. So I guess what's one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey?
Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the book basically tells you, do you want to be, which quadrant do you want to be in? ESBI, I want to be an investor. That's where my wealth came about. Even in my W-2 days, I made more money from my investments than my salary. So I have to be an investor and reduce my taxes.
Yeah, well, the Rich Dad Poor Dad is definitely the book that had the light bulb go off in my brain. So I totally agree with that. And that actually may answer the next question. But I guess, what's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Well, I actually like this book, Next Level Your Life, in which I'm one of the co-authors. And there's about 30, 40 of us each writing our story of how we came about into our entrepreneurship journey. Awesome. And so hopefully one of them is relatable.
No, that's great. I have not read that book, but I'll definitely have to add it to my list to check out for sure. And last question here, if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you can live an amazing life just off of the passive income from real estate, what would you do?
I would probably go back to my passion projects that I'm still working on, one of which is financial literacy and math tutoring for kids. I've done that free for over a decade, and it's very exciting to see some of them who failed algebra in high school graduating from engineering college. Very thrilling.
Awesome. No, that sounds like a very interesting and well, much needed kind of project. So I really, really appreciate you being on the podcast. How can people find you, reach out to you if they want to learn more about your story, if they want to check out your book? Like, what does that look like for you?
So Next Level Your Life, the book can be ordered from Amazon. Engineered Capital is my company name. So engineered-capital.com is my website. LinkedIn and Facebook are the two platforms where I post the most. And of course, they can find me through you.
Yeah, no, definitely found you on LinkedIn. I've been following your stuff for a while, so I'm glad. Really, really appreciate you being on the podcast. And yeah, we'll talk soon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been an honor.
Awesome. Thank you.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.